It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how to cope amid difficult and uncertain economic times and explore strategies for smart money moves. Call in with all your questions about money management and the financial situations you encounter. The number to join in on this personal finance conversation, it's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Keith Ponywaz is here, Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Well, the last time we chatted, last August, we talked about whether our nation is headed toward recession. What is your view on that trajectory now?
Well, you know, this is the rare event that I think got the Wall Street Journal to cite French existential literature. They compared the situation we're in to waiting for Godot, that we're all kind of sitting around waiting for a recession. And, it's very interesting because, you know, if you look at certain numbers, things are very, very good. Unemployment is at record lows. Wages are coming up. But what has happened in response to, you know, the economy kind of chugging along and really growing quite well out of everything that happened around the COVID pandemic is inflation then has shot up. And in response, the Federal Reserve has started raising interest rates. And we're now, you know, generally around 5%. And they do that for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, when it's harder to borrow money, generally then businesses undertake fewer projects, try to grow a little more controlled, and they don't hire as much, and that cools off the job market a little bit. And because of that, then prices start to come down and so on and so forth. And so, you know, we've been waiting, and you know, one of the things is some of it, I think, is almost people feel like, you know, there was a lot of economic damage for COVID, from COVID. But when we were, you know, at the beginning of it, we thought it was going to be much worse. And we feel like we've almost gotten away with it almost. And so, you know, one of the things that we're looking at right now is the possibility of a soft landing where the Fed raises interest rates, they slow growth a little bit, but we don't dip into a full blown recession. And I think, and we can talk about the inflation numbers today at 4.9%. Those, I think, may help the Fed look at pausing interest rate hikes and seeing how things play out. And so that's, you know, really one of the big questions. But I think, you know, if you spoke with me, you know, back in August, when we spoke, I would have been more in line with the possibility of a recession coming. But now I think, you know, we're looking at the soft landing possibility has gotten stronger.
Okay. So Jay Powell would nod his head and approve of that.
Yeah. You know, he's got a very difficult job, especially now that raising interest rates has caused, you know, bank failures. And
we'll be talking about that in a heartbeat. But, you know, just taking a bit of an informal survey, just a bit of a pulse here, what questions are your clients often asking in these economic times?
Yeah, you know, one is, you know, and we'll talk about the bank situation here in a little bit, but is my money safe in banks? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is we've seen the stock market go down, and people ask, well, you know, is it still a good time to invest? Should I still put, you know, money in? And you know, one of the old saws among financial advisors is the stock market is the only thing that people refuse to buy on sale. You know, when it goes down, people get nervous and they don't want to invest. We still think, you know, underlying everything, the fundamentals of the U.S. and global economy are strong. There's always uncertainty. In fact, you know, I worried this morning that your listeners would hear my voice and, you know, have a Pavlovian kind of reaction that it's on, you know, uncertainty. Uh-oh. But, you know, there's always uncertainty in the markets. And, yeah. And you know, I think we've come out of a really, you know, crazy situation from, I can't think of another way of describing the COVID pandemic. And I think if you had talked to economic forecasters in March of 2020, when the stock market went down nearly 40%, none of them would have predicted that we'd be where we are today in some sense. So I think, you know, there is some hurdles and there is some, you know, concern, but the economy has proved remarkably resilient.
Well, there's no here. Keith Boney was with us, Madison-based financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors, as we talk about investment tips, other financial advice, and get a read on these economic times with your insights and your questions about money matters front and center at 800-642-1234. Join the conversation with your question. Email ideas at WPR.org. Digging now into interest rates, and you mentioned the Fed, you know, raising interest rates to levels not seen since the 80s to cool the inflation that we are so much experiencing. What should people do with their money during periods of high inflation?
And so this is an excellent question because, you know, it depends on what the time horizon is for the money. You know, one of the nice things right now is, you know, for a long period of time, you couldn't, you know, you were getting, and there's an, you know, a technical term for this, I think, bupkis in your interest rate, right? If you had a savings account, if you're looking for a CD, something like that. So if you have money that you're saving for the next 6 months, a year, all of a sudden CDs, you know, savings accounts look a little bit more attractive. Particularly, you know, what has happened with some of the supply chain bottlenecks and so on is you may place an order for a car, but it may not show up for 6 months and you have that money ready to go for that car. And it's a good time to just park it in a CD and you know, take 5% interest, which is very much unheard of. Longer term, you know, the question is, will we see inflation continue for a long period of time? And the market is suggesting we're not. And this is kind of one of the interesting things. If you're putting money away for a year or two, you're actually getting a better interest rate than if you're putting it away for 10 years. And so one of the things that you know, is a good protection for your investments against inflation is actually the stock market. It will, you know, if we keep raising interest rates, the valuations will go down, but it does grow because companies end up making more money. It's just inflation adjusted more money. And, you know, but their price will increase. So it is also a good place to go. And then the final is, you know, there are things like treasury inflation protected securities, TIPS, which may be if you're really worried about the longer term, you know, concerns about inflation, those are always a good place to look as well.
I want to go back to one thing you said there about the car that's not ready yet. I mean, financing vehicles right now, you're looking at vehicles that run 50,000, 70,000 or more. I mean, if you have to finance something right now, like a car, what is the best way to do it with the cost of a loan going increasingly higher with the Fed trying to deal with inflation?
Yeah. You know, first is obviously try not to finance if possible. The second, and you know, with a car loan, it's a little bit more difficult. But one thing, you know, we remind people with houses, house purchases, for instance, and the real estate market is a whole separate sort of, you know, issue. Yeah, exactly. Is that you can, you know, with things like that, refinance with a mortgage, right? If interest rates go down in a couple of years from 6.5-7%, you can go and refinance. And then, you know, if possible, leasing also becomes a possibility, right? If you lease for this time period, if you think interest rates are going to come down in 2 to 3 years, you know, that's also a possibility and something to look at.
Keith Boney was our guide to Money Matters, a financial advisor. Join in by calling with your question, your comments at any time, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the banking system under stress, inflation, eating away at paychecks, rising interest rates, as we've been talking about, we seek insights from a Wisconsin financial advisor. Call in with what's on your mind about your financial position. The number to join in with your personal finance question, 800-642-1234. Send your email about a money matter to ideas@wpr.org. Keith Ponywaz is Director of International Advisory Services for a financial advisory firm. So, Keith, let's look at the banking sector. We saw this month government regulators seized First Republic Bank. This is the third bank to fail this year after Signature did. Silicon Valley Bank collapsed in March. Are people's deposits safe? What's going on?
The first thing that I'll say off the top is for 99% of your listeners, their deposits are absolutely 100% safe. Since the 1930s, we have regulation where we created the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, which is basically bank funded insurance for depositors with under 250,000. So I would guess that most of your listeners have less than 250,000 in their bank. In those cases, their deposits are absolutely protected. And they're quite all right. The question of what's going on is a little bit more complicated, but it has to do a little bit with what we were talking about just before the news break. We're in an interesting situation whereby right now, short-term deposits are paying a higher interest rate than longer-term deposits and loans. What economists and folks in the finance industry call an inverted yield curve. Usually, if I give you the money and expect you to pay it back in 6 months, I'm going to charge you less interest than for 30 years, let's say, because 6 months is a little bit more predictable. 30 years, a lot could go on in 30 years. Think back to the 1990s, right, compared to today. We didn't have the internet back then, but, what you have then is that risk. Well, because the Fed has been raising interest rates, lots of banks, when interest rates were very low, took deposits and put them in longer duration securities to get a little bit better value, right? A little bit more return on their money. And so what they, at that point we're getting 1.5-2% interest. And now, as interest rates have come up in the short term, they have to pay depositors a little bit more than they were before, which was, again, between 0.25, real low amount, and it's creeping up towards that. That eats into their profit margins a little bit. What happened in the specific case of Silicon Valley Bank is they had lots and lots of uninsured depositors. They had lots of firms with over 250,000 with them. And in that case, if a bank fails, and there have been 563 bank failures since 2001, so they're not, uncommon, they're not unknown. And since 2008, 2009, every bank that has failed, every single depositor has been made whole. Despite that, they were worried. And what happened specifically with Silicon Valley Bank to trigger that is they served a lot of startups, a lot of companies that, your normal business may have more than 250,000 in the bank at any given moment, but it's going to go out because, on the 15th of the month here, paychecks go out, right? Mm-hmm. On the first of the month, paychecks go out. So they accumulate money and then it goes out again and it, goes up and goes down, but it's never, whereas Silicon Valley startups, they assemble huge amounts of money from funding rounds and so on. And so they have these big accounts and they're drawing them down, right? And so what happened was in Silicon Valley Bank's case is they ended up drawing them down faster than Silicon Valley Bank was ready for. They had to write down some assets, some long-term treasuries. These were not, this wasn't like 2007, 2008, where you had synthetic debt obligations and collateralized debt obligations. These were long-term U.S. treasuries. Mm-hmm. But because they bought them at 1.5% and now a longer duration treasury is making you more money, 3.5-4%, the value of those went down. So they had to take a loss to sell those, redeem them, to pay, you know, out their depositors. And when, you know, people got wind of this, and then they looked at how many uninsured depositors there were, you had, you know, what I would call an old fashioned bank run. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot like It's a Wonderful Life. Where, if you remember at the Bailey,
you're going to bring your literature background into this at any point in time. And I'm along for the ride. Yes.
Well, you know, I think it's the most famous bank run that people remember.
Yes, right? And yes,
basically, you know, everybody came and they wanted their money back right there. Right. And they were undercapitalized, but they were lucky because they had the wedding money. And so, you know, they were able to, you know, tied everyone over. And that's what Silicon Valley Bank did. It's also what First Republic Bank did. If you remember, you know, they went to JP Morgan and a bunch of large banks to get money from them to help, you know, shore up their balance sheet. And so it was like bringing out the wedding cash in that case. And so you had all these depositors and they needed to bring in money to make sure they had that money on hand.
And I get that, you know, Silicon Valley is a bit of a different storyline, if you will, because of the startups and the nature of what happens there. But specifically regional banks struggling is what I'm wondering about, especially Midwest ones. What might be happening at the regional bank level?
Well, first of all, a little bit of it is guilt by association. And, you know, so what you're looking at there is, you know, everybody, you know, talks about how rational and wise the stock market is, right? Mm-hmm. But I think Warren Buffett once said very wisely, right, in the long run, the stock market is an adding machine, right? But in the short run, it's a popularity contest. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is a lot of regional banks are looked at and treated with guilt by association, right? So that's what's driving down a lot of the stock prices. You'll see, you know, First Republic, the other regional bank that failed, was in California. Mm-hmm. The other, you know, much like Silicon Valley Bank and you know, had a similar demographic, we'll say, in terms of its customers. The other thing that is different for regional banks is how they are regulated. So in response to the fiscal crisis of 2007 to 2009, basically the federal government created a class of what are called systematically important banks. And they get regular stress testing, regular reviews of their balance sheet, and making sure that they are prepared for these scenarios. Mm. What happened in the case of regional banks is they're not as highly scrutinized, partially because there was some lobbying that happened in 2017, 2018, partially because, you know, they don't have the resources of the giant banks do in terms of back office accounting and, you know, all of those things.
To go through these scenarios. Yep. Yes. I just want to pause here and reintroduce you, Keith Ponywaz, as we talk investment, stocks, bonds, and the banking industry. Get financial tips along the way. 800-642-1234. Carson in Buffalo County is here. Carson, what's your question?
Yeah, I'm always surprised, you know, when stocks go down and the financial advisors say, well, just stick around, it'll turn, you know. But I worked for a credit card company back in the 1990s and early 2000s, and they went under, and then Washington Mutual bought them out. And so my stock went from $42 to $2. Mm. So, no, things don't always work out for people. All right? Just accept that. Thank you.
Carson, thank you for bringing that scenario. What do you make of that, Keith, that it doesn't always work out well?
Well, I think Carson brings up an interesting dilemma and one that we work really hard with our clients to resolve. And, you know, for a lot of clients, a lot of folks, they work for a company, and we saw it less or more, you know, back in the 90s and the 80s, is they work for a company, they get stock options, they get the chance to buy their stock at a discount. They may be, you know, as a bonus gifted stock. And what you end up with in those cases is too much wealth concentrated in one stock. And so when, you know, I talk about the stock market, I'm not talking about individual companies, but the broader U.S. economy, where you're buying Apple and bank stocks, right? And you're not buying just one stock. You're buying hopefully many different stocks. And even now with low-cost ETFs, you can diversify internationally and you can buy the global markets as well. And so that's one of the real risks is, yes, not all stocks recover, but the stock market on a whole has recovered and has done quite well. And
And
so the
I just want to pause there again. Financial advisor Keith Ponywaz, fielding questions about money and portfolio management. Call in with your question, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss saving and investing as inflation takes a long-term toll on household budgets. What's on your mind about retirement, about debt, the ability to make ends meet? Call in with a personal finance question or a money move you've made and want to talk about. Call in with your question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Keith Ponywaz is Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors. Keith, let's touch down for a moment here on the debt ceiling impasse. The federal government could default on its debt as soon as June 1st unless the borrowing limit is raised. How would a default on America's credit affect the economy?
You know, in terms of exactly how it might affect it, I'll be honest, I don't know. You know, it's not going to be good. How bad it would be is a big question. And I think it would also speak to or cause problems in bigger picture, just beyond sort of the short term. You know, one of the things about the United States is we are the world's reserve currency, which means, you know, when people have deposits or, you know, if they're doing transactions and you know, their two currencies frequently will pass through dollars or the U.S. markets will be involved. And the U.S. Treasury is viewed as the world's kind of safest asset. It's the place where people go if they are looking for, you know, absolutely kind of no risk. And so one of the big concerns is that a default would mean, you know, those assets all of a sudden lose, you know, value. We lose our place in the kind of world economic order, and it could really slow down growth, not just in the short term, but in the longer term, because we've, you know, we lose trust with our trading partners and as kind of a global marketplace. You know, if eBay didn't deliver your goods, you would be less likely to use eBay. And in some sense, you know, for a lot of transactions, the US dollar and US treasuries serve that kind of function as a global marketplace. So it's certainly not something that would be great in the long term. In terms of the short term effects, it's really hard to prognosticate, you know, because we've never seen it before.
It's just something to keep a watchful eye on as we look at the news cycle here. Let's take a call now. Tom in Whitewater. Tom, hi. What would you like to ask?
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. My family and I have been through a lot with some catastrophic medical expenses, and we've reached out to a number of financial advisors to see if there are strategies for growing the money that we have. And without fail, every last one has said, no, the best you can do is put your money in a CD and let it grow over several years. You can't really play the market. In listening to you talk, it sounds like you may have some strategies for growth, and I was just hoping to find out what your thoughts are. Is it possible to grow your wealth through the stock market in this climate, or at least start a portfolio that could grow over the next few years?
Tom, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your question, Tom. So this is where it gets into really kind of difficult questions, right? Because a few years, you know, we're talking, is it 2, 3? Is it 5, 10? Because, you know, the you know, overall idea would be, you know, what can you invest into guarantee returns over the next 3 years? Well, there are no guarantees. Now, if you have a large pool of money, there are other options out there. With interest rates rising, instead of maybe just a CD, you could also look at various bonds. Now, again, those are not no risk, no chance of downside. So, the question is, over the next few years, is the goal here to, do you have a specific expense in mind that you need to meet? In which case, the advice you've been receiving is makes sense, right? You can't, if you have to pay something in 3 years, you don't want to expose it to the market. But if your timeline is a little bit more flexible, if you don't need all of the money in 3, 5, 7 years, then a balanced portfolio. And again, this speaks back to Carson's question. When we speak about diversification, we're not just talking about, diversification within stocks, but we're also looking at bonds and other kind of asset classes as well. And when you do that, you can look at a longer term return and kind of look at, various items. So, it depends a little bit on, how firm that couple year deadline is for Tom. If it's, we're getting set for retirement, we have this nest egg and we want to invest it and not touch it. And, in 3 or 4 years, we'll start touching a little bit of it for retirement, then maybe the market is a good place. But if it's 2 years and we need to draw on the money for these specific things, then a very safe asset like a bond or a U.S. Treasury or a CD becomes the best place to go with it.
Tom, thank you so much for that question. Ellen now in Cedarburg. Ellen, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking of low-income people who are usually left out of these conversations, and I'm thinking, what does your guest think of the idea of a required financial literacy class for kids in schools, kids in public schools? I think parents who are low-income would really appreciate it if someone would help their children, advance financially. What
Ellen,
does he think of,
yes,
that?
Ellen, thank you so much for making that point. And how do we educate kids on financial literacy, Keith?
Yeah, no, I think your caller raises an excellent, excellent point. Part of the reason I'm a financial advisor is I got very lucky. As you mentioned before I became a financial advisor, I was a French professor. But I grew up in a family with two CPAs. And I can remember sitting around the table with my family talking about the stock market crash of 1987 or about the power of compound interest. And I think, that's something, that kind of education that in a lot of cases, folks in my situation, take for granted is not a given. One of the things that when I started out, I worked with immigrant communities in terms of helping them try to understand the U.S. financial system, all of the various things, because people, that immigrants to this country are, many of them are entrepreneurs. They start a new business and they don't have a model for how do I save for retirement. They don't understand things like 401ks and so on and so forth. So I think that sort of financial literacy is absolutely crucial. It helps people make, much better choices, even in terms of small things, and understanding as well why, the stock market in the long run can be a good thing, why putting money in the bank and not saving it right away can be a good thing. But it also hopefully, helps people in their jobs, right? They can understand maybe why you do things one way versus another. So I think, the point about financial literacy and courses would be great. I think that sort of thing, I don't know, I've left education. I don't know how you would implement it in terms of larger questions of the curriculum and so on. But I do think it's something that would be absolutely wonderful for folks.
Keith Poniewoz with us as we get investing tips, other financial advice. And with your questions front and center. Join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to turn to RMDs, required minimum distributions. And this year, with the $1.7 trillion legislative package changing several aspects to RMDs, which of these changes should people saving for retirement be aware of?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that, you know, people should be aware of. The first is, traditionally, before the SECURE Act 1.0, which changed a lot of the things in terms of how retirements and so on went, is that the RMD age went from 70 and a half to 72. So if you turn 72 in a sort of course of a year, your RMD age went up. Basically, if you were born after July 1st, 1949 to 1950, your RMD age became 72. What has changed is, now if you're born from 1951 to 1959, your RMD age is now 73. So you don't have to take and a required minimum distribution means, if you have an IRA, 401k, you have to take a certain amount out every year. That's changed now. If you're born from 1951 to 1959 to 73 or above. And then in basically 2033, so if you're born after 1960, you don't have to start taking those withdrawals until you're 75.
Okay. So how can someone calculate? I mean, you throw out a lot of ages and numbers there. Yeah. How does someone calculate their required monthly minimum distribution?
Yeah. And so one of the nice things is, you don't have to do it monthly. You can do it annually as well. Some people like to take it at the beginning of the year. Some people like to take it quarterly. Some people do take it monthly. And it's calculated based on the value of your portfolio on December 31st of the prior year. And what most big financial firms offer is a nice handy calculator that will basically allow you to type in your age, you know, when you were born, type in your value on December 31st, and then, you know, give you how much you need to take out that year. And the nice thing is, now more and more custodians or brokerages, Vanguard, Charles Schwab, et cetera, are building these things in. So when you click into your IRA account with your custodian, in a lot of cases, they'll just have it pulled up and say, oh, you need to take out this much this year, and you don't even need the calculator. But if you still have questions, you know, your financial advisor is a great place to reach out to.
Keith Ponywas, Wisconsin financial advisor, here to answer all money questions. Be part of the conversation. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get tips and insight from Keith Ponywas, financial advisor in Madison. Keith, we heard from Denise in Bayfield, called in and wants to know the difference between CDs, bonds, and treasury notes. What are some of the risks that Denise should be aware of, and how do they choose which is best for the short term?
Yep, that's an excellent question from Denise. A treasury bond and a treasury note are very similar. It's basically a question of time. Treasury bonds, treasury bills, treasury notes are all basically the equivalent of a CD that the U.S. government issues to consumers. And T-notes, treasury notes, are between 2 and 10 years. T-bills are basically shorter than 1 year. And a T-bond, a treasury bond, is longer term, over 10 years. Generally, you know, end up when we talk to clients frequently, we use treasury bonds and treasury bills interchangeably. So you may see some overlap there. And in all cases, basically, it's a you are basically financing a loan. So in the case of a CD with a bank, the borrower is the bank. You give them the money for a fixed amount of time. They give you interest back, much like, you know, the bank does with you and your mortgage, right? In the case of a treasury bond or bill or note, the borrower is the U.S. government, which, you know, speaks back to what we were talking about in terms of the breaching of the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, you are loaning the money to the United States government. They are paying you back with interest. And so, and then, you know, the other kind of bonds you may see, you know, you can see foreign bonds issued in English, issued in U.S. dollars. So foreign nations will come to the U.S. market and use the U.S. dollar to issue a bond, you know, with their interest rate. And then you can also see corporate bonds where businesses, in order to finance projects, will also loan money to you. And then the final, or borrow money from you, pardon. And then the final kind of group would be municipal bonds. So a school district, a water district, something like that, will be looking for money for a project or generally financing their needs, and they will offer you a loan. And one of the nice things about a municipal bond is it's not federally taxed. So in that case, you might get a little lower interest rate because you don't have to pay tax on it. But, you know, that is the upside. In terms of risks, you know, treasury bonds and CDs, I would say, are very close together. Essentially, you know, now in the case of, you know, a failure of the U.S. government and so on, that could cause, you know, various problems throughout the system. A CD is generally insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So if you're taking out a CD for less than $250,000, again, it's going to be safe and secure with your bank. But I wouldn't consider that more secure than a U.S. Treasury.
Okay.
Because if the U.S. Treasury isn't making payments, then the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is going to have all sorts of problems as well. So it's, you know, I wouldn't view it as necessarily safer.
Okay.
And in many cases, you can get a little bit better rate with a U.S. Treasury bond than you could with your, you know, local provider. The other thing to be aware of right now is that, you know, we're living in this weird world where interest rates are higher if you're borrowing or loaning money for a short term, less than 2 years. So one thing people may want to look at is, you know, when do you need that money by? If it's a shorter term, it may make sense to get a 2-year treasury instead of a 3-year treasury, or 2-year CD instead of a 3-year CD.
Look at those timelines. But, yes.
Yep,
Denise,
exactly.
Thank you. Kay in Spring Green, you're next. Kay, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
So this is Kay. I have a question. I'm turning 73 next year and will be required to take my required minimum. And I'm invested with a diversified portfolio. And my friend, who's also turning 73, has advised me that she is going to take her money out of her IRA and put it in Roth IRAs because it's safer. And it'll be cheaper because the stocks are down right now. So I'm just wondering if that's a valid
option for when go ahead, Keith.
Yeah. So this is a case where, first of all, let's, you know, clarify a traditional IRA versus a Roth IRA. A traditional IRA involves you paying tax when you pull the money out. You get a tax deduction when you put the money in. You pay tax when you pull the money out. So in that conversion, right, in moving it from the IRA to the Roth IRA, when you put the money in, you don't get a tax deduction, but it grows tax-free, right? And everything is great there. And then when you pull it out, you don't have to pay any tax. So there is something called a Roth conversion, and we really recommend it for younger people, in particular, because what frequently you have to worry about is if you're converting the whole amount when you're 72, 73, is you might actually move up a tax bracket, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you may be in the 12% tax bracket. And if you convert the whole amount of your IRA, you could go up to the 22 or 24% tax bracket. But, you know, you up that and you're paying all this extra tax now, which is reducing how much capital you have in that Roth IRA. And it will have, as you get older, less time to grow. It's something that, to be honest with you, so many of our decisions, when we're looking at things related to stock, we're thinking about the stock market. But in a lot of cases, these are life and tax questions in a lot of cases. And so this is a case where, you know, Denise should take a look if, you know, she has her investments with a large, you know, someone like Vanguard or Fidelity. There may be a retirement counselor available to her for her IRA or 401k to talk about whether this is the best choice. Because what we do is we take the inputs of age, how much money there is, how much you're going to be making going forward, what's your estimated tax rate going to be, and find out what's the break-even point. How much does the stock market have to go up for there to be a break even for you on this Roth conversion? So the way, you know, Denise's friend pitched this is it's a one size fits all because where the stock market is right now solution. There are not many one size fits all solutions in this world. And so you have to make sure, you know, does it fit with your plan? Where are you tax wise? And then make the decision kind of working back from those questions and then figure out what's the return rate for you to have a break even.
Kay, thanks so much for the call. We only have about 20 seconds left, but just a quick touchdown here on Lucy and Wanakee, who wants to get your opinion on Bitcoin, other cryptocurrency, what we should be thinking right now.
I'm not a big fan of Bitcoin and crypto. I think a lot of volatility in that market. And so for people who want to save and invest for retirement, it's not necessarily the best place to go. It also has, I think, some problems in terms of economics. Currency is supposed to be a stable store of value. Bitcoin is designed, you know, people want to make money off of it. And that means it defeats its purpose as a currency.
Keith, always great. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate. Really appreciate it.
Keith Poniewoz, Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.